Good evening. We invite your attention to the scripture listed on the card. Excuse me, Daniel chapter 3. Daniel falls in line there. Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Daniel. As we looked at Acts chapter 10 in a Sunday school lesson this morning, a verse caught my attention. Verse 33, the second part of it. I think it takes in everybody here tonight, including Brother Leon. It says there, "Now therefore are we all here present before God to hear all things that are commanded thee of God." That's why we're gathered together here tonight, to hear what our brother has to speak to us from the Lord. And as I was sitting here looking over the scripture to be read, my mind went back many years ago. I know this is not a memorial service, but to Sister Annabelle Hoover, to Sister Dorothy Nell, back in the Sunday school rooms, I think the boiler room's there today. We sat and listened to these Bible accounts under their teaching so many years ago. We're thankful that we have had those memories. And today we read them again. They're just as powerful now as they were then. So we'll read the entire chapter of Daniel chapter 3. Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold whose height was 60 cubits and the breadth thereof 6 cubits. He set it up in the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Then Nebuchadnezzar the king sent to gather together the princes, the governors, and the captains, the judges, the treasurers, the counselors, the sheriffs, and all of the rulers of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image which Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. Then the princes, the governors, and captains, the judges, the treasurers, the counselors, the sheriffs, and all the rulers of the provinces were gathered together unto the dedication of the image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then an herald cried aloud, "To you it is commanded, O people, nations, and languages, that at what time ye hear the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, dulcimer, and all kinds of music, ye fall down and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king hath set up. And whoso falleth not down and worshipeth shall the same hour be cast into the midst of a burning fiery furnace." Therefore, at that time, when all the people heard the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, and all kinds of music, all the people, the nations, and the languages fell down and worshipped the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. Wherefore, at that time, certain Chaldeans came near and accused the Jews. They spake and said to the king Nebuchadnezzar, "O king, live forever. Thou, O king, hast made a decree that every man that shall hear the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, and dulcimer, and all kinds of music, shall fall down and worship the golden image. And whoso falleth not down and worshipeth, that he should be cast into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. There are certain Jews whom thou hast set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have not regarded thee, they serve not thy gods, nor worship the golden image which thou hast set up." Then Nebuchadnezzar, in his rage and fury, commanded to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Then they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar spake and said unto them, "Is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego? Do not ye serve my gods, nor worship the golden image which I have set up. Now if ye be ready, that at what time ye hear the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, and dulcimer, and all kinds of music, ye fall down and worship the image which I have made, well. But if ye worship not, ye shall be cast the same hour into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. And who is that God that shall deliver you out of my hands?" Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we are not careful to answer thee in this matter. If it be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of thine hand, O king. But if not, be it known unto thee, O king, that we will not serve thy gods, nor worship the golden image which thou hast set up." Then was Nebuchadnezzar full of fury, And the form of his visage was changed against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Therefore he spake and commanded that they should heat the furnace one 7 times more than it was wont to be heated. And he commanded the most mighty men that were in his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and to cast them into the burning fiery furnace. Then these men were bound in their coats, their hosen and their hats, and their other garments, and were cast into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. Therefore, because the king's commandment was urgent, and the furnace exceeding hot, the flame of the fire slew those men that took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these 3 men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell down bound into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. Then Nebuchadnezzar the king was astonished, and rose up in haste, and spake, and said unto his counselors, Did not we cast 3 men bound into the midst of the fire? They answered and said unto the king, True, O king. He answered and said, Lo, I see 4 men loose, walking in the midst of the fire, and they have no hurt, and the form of the 4th is like the Son of God. Then Nebuchadnezzar came near to the mouth of the burning fiery furnace, and spake, and said, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, ye servants of the Most High God, come forth and come hither. Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came forth of the midst of the fire. And the princes, governors, and captains, and the king's counselors, being gathered together, saw these men upon whose bodies the fire had no power, nor was an hair of their head singed, neither was their coats changed, nor the smell of fire had passed on them. Then Nebuchadnezzar spake and said, Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who hath sent his angel and delivered his servants that trusted in him, and have changed the king's word and yielded their bodies that they might not serve nor worship any god except their own God. Therefore I make a decree that every people, nation, and language which speak anything amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be cut in pieces, and their houses shall be made a dunghill, because there is no other God that can deliver after this sort. Then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. And we will now bow down and pray to the Lord our God.
I want to take this opportunity to express thanks to this congregation. It seems, those words seem rather pitiful and insignificant in comparison to what you've given me. You've given me a lot more than I've given you. Prayers, hospitality, food, and many other things that you've given me. I greatly appreciate it, and I wish I could speak words more flowery than that, but I can't. I pray God's blessings on you as a congregation, as you continue to stand for him. The story that Brother Larry read is a true story. Let me back up. I knew there was something else I wanted to say. Paul told the believers at Corinth that they refreshed his spirit. And they're the words that come to my mind, that you have refreshed my spirit. And so I pray that God would bless you for that too. Now, back to where I was. The story that Larry read is a true story. It happened in a certain place at a certain time in history. But it is perhaps hard for us to really relate to it because it's a different culture. There's a king. There's an image, and it's just kind of hard for us to really relate to that in our present time and age. But there are, in this story, some universal principles that are true in every age and in every culture. And I'd like to pull those out tonight to our attention and think about them. The first one is that the majority of the world's rulers oppose God's rule. We see Nebuchadnezzar here as a king who opposed God. In chapter 2 of Daniel, He had a dream, and in this dream he saw an image with various metals, and Daniel interpreted the dream to him. And in this dream, the head of the image was of gold, and Daniel told Nebuchadnezzar that he was that head of gold. But now in chapter 3, Nebuchadnezzar builds an image of his own, and the whole thing's of gold. Was this image an attempt to show that his kingdom wasn't going to pass away into the silver and bronze and iron kingdoms? Was this image an attempt to prove that he was the one to be worshipped? I'm not sure. But he built this image and commanded all his people to worship it and not the true God of heaven. It's always been this way. The first kingdom that the Bible speaks of was the kingdom of Nimrod. And although the Bible doesn't say too much about Nimrod, Josephus was a Jewish historian who adds some more details to the story. He tells us Nimrod was a tyrant. He led the people in rebellion against God. He gradually changed the government into tyranny, seeing no other way of turning men from God but to bring them into dependence on his power. Jesus said that the rulers of this world, those that are counted to rule over Gentiles, exercise lordship over them. You know, it's hard to lord over people and still be submissive to God. Power, by its very nature, expands. There's always a need to restrain power. I don't think we ever have to encourage power to grow. It just does it on its own. God's design was to decentralize power. But man tends to centralize power and to build power. And that power is in opposition to God. Psalms chapter 2 speaks of the rulers of this world talk among themselves and wish to throw off the authority of God. Exodus 5:2 is Pharaoh. Pharaoh, when he was confronted with Moses, said, "Who is the Lord that I should listen to him and to you?" These are my words, but that's what they say. And Daniel 11 speaks about a future ruler who will know no God. Verse 36. "The king shall do according to his will, and he shall exalt himself and magnify himself above every god, and shall speak marvelous things against the God of gods, and shall prosper till the indignation be accomplished, for that is determined shall be done. Neither shall he regard the God of his fathers, nor the desire of women, nor regard any god, for he shall magnify himself above all." Prophecy is never crystal clear, but it appears this might be speaking of the last king of the earth, the Antichrist. Now the Bible does say that although the majority of the world's rulers are in opposition to God, God still has things under his control. It's somewhat hard to put those two ideas together. I mean, Proverbs talks about the king's heart is in the hand of the Lord, and he directs it wherever he wills. And Daniel, in chapter 4, told Nebuchadnezzar that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men and giveth it to whomsoever he will and setteth up over it the basest of men. But yet, they're under the influence of Satan. I mean, Jesus talked about Satan as being the prince of this world. He's in charge of this world. And in the temptation of Jesus, Satan offered Jesus the kingdoms of this world and the glory of them. And Jesus did not contradict him, that he was telling a lie at that point. You know, it's not impossible to have a godly leader, but he has two strikes against him before he even starts. So we should not be surprised when the rulers and those in power oppose God. Now this is naturally followed by the thought that when the power is in the hands of those that oppose God, then the followers of God will be persecuted. The Bible says that Nimrod was a hunter. And we get this benign picture of a hunter as one who goes out and shoots deer and brings it home for his family. But that's not what this means. He was a hunter of men, a persecutor of the followers of God. The Hebrew word hunter means to chase. And the Hebrew word persecute means to run after. And the Greek word persecute means to pursue. So the idea here of Nimrod being a hunter was that he persecuted the followers of the true God. Jesus warned us that this would happen. He said, the world will hate you. It hated me, it's going to hate you. Paul told Timothy, he said, those that live godly in Jesus Christ will be persecuted. And so throughout the ages, the followers of the true God have been killed and become martyrs. Now sometimes we think of martyrs, we think about the Christians being thrown to the lions in the Roman Colosseum or being burned at the stake during the Reformation. But the truth is, there have been more believers put to death in the 20th century, 1900 to 1999, than in all the centuries before that. And if the last 19 years continue to run as they have, there's going to be even more martyrs now than there's ever been before. We also see in this story the power of music. I don't know if you noticed or not how often it spoke of music. Sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, dulcimer, and all kinds of music. He says that over and over again. Music is a major influence, first of all, because of its very nature. When you read a book, the words and the truths or errors are processed by your mind before they enter your spirit. Music bypasses the mind. Music influence has a direct influence on your spirit. And so it has a power to influence without us even recognizing it. Music is also pervasive. Where can you go in this world and not be assaulted with either music or things that pretend to be music? It's so pervasive. And so the power of music must be recognized. There is good music and there is bad music. Now, whether music is good or bad is not determined by your personal tastes. It's not determined by the age or how long ago it was written or whatever type it is. There are objective standards by which music can be evaluated. And that's way beyond the scope of this message, so I'll just leave that there. But God's design for music was that it would bring Him glory and would edify believers. The book of Psalms is a collection of music. And they were written to glorify God and to edify believers. Ephesians chapter 5, 19 talks about singing, speaking to yourselves in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs in order to glorify God and to edify one another. The world has twisted music so that it does neither. This twisted music is what is I call bad music. We know that good music will drive away evil spirits. What did Saul do to find relief from an evil spirit? He had David play the harp. Even today, people, even non-Christian people, find that they can drive away undesirable characters by playing classical music or some kind of good music, because evil spirits cannot stand it. Bad music influences your spirit negatively. And so with all the forces of the world trying to trip you up, we need all the help we can get. So music is an aid. Good music is an aid in edifying our spirit. And bad music is a thing that will trip us up and lead us in the wrong way. We also see in this story that God is able to deliver. Verse 17, if it be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and He will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known to thee, O king, we will not serve thy gods nor worship the golden image which thou hast set up. God is able to deliver, but He might not deliver. Deliverance does not depend on your righteousness. Job, the Bible says, was a righteous man and eschewed evil, yet he suffered the assault of Satan. Deliverance does not depend on your faith. In Hebrews 11, it speaks about all these people who experienced great deliverance because of their faith. And then almost without a comma, it says, but others were stoned, sawn asunder, wandered destitute in caves, not accepting release in order to follow God. God delivered Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego from the fiery furnace, but nearly 300 believers were burned at the stake in England in the 1600s. They all perished. None of them were delivered. So God may heal your loved one of cancer, or he may let you suffer watching them die inch by inch. God may miraculously pay your $80,000 hospital bill, or you may have to struggle for the rest of your life to pay it off. I don't know why. I don't know if any of you do. Why God delivers sometimes and doesn't sometimes, but it's a universal principle. We need to recognize that God is able to deliver, but he may not deliver for some reason to bring him glory. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego overcame the pressure against them because they were not afraid of death. A man or woman that is not afraid to die is unconquerable. How can you conquer someone that is not afraid to die? You say, well, you do this or I'll kill you. Go ahead. To live is gain. To die is, what did Paul say? To live is to be with Christ. To die is gain. Those words are mixed up. But either whether we live or die, we're with Christ. Because they are not afraid of death, they knew they would be with God. Because of this confidence, they could give verbal testimony of God. It's interesting. Revelation 12:11 speaks about the victory over Satan. It says they overcame him by the blood of the Lamb, by the word of their testimony, and they were not afraid of death. They were not afraid of death because they were covered by the blood of the Lamb. And because they were not afraid of death, they could handle a word of their testimony. I once read that the book of Revelation was written in a chiastic form. And I had no clue what that meant, but I was curious enough to do some research. And what chiastic means is that it's a different format than what we're used to. In our society, in our culture, in our literature, we're used to a story beginning and building and building and building, and then a climax comes real close to the end, the main point. But chiastic literature, it uses parallels at the beginning and the end, and the main point is at the center. So in the book of Revelation, we have at the beginning it speaks of the church, and at the end it speaks of the church. In chapter 8 and 9, we have seven trumpets. In chapter 16, we have seven vials. And then one step closer to the center, in chapter 11, we have two witnesses. In chapter 13, we have two beasts. So chapter 12 becomes the center. If you would count the verses, you will find that in the first 11 chapters of Revelation, there are 194 verses. And in chapter 13 through 22, there is 194 verses. So chapter 12 is the main point. It is the central. It is the point the writer was making. If you would read through Revelation from chapter 1 to 22, chapter 12 kind of seems out of place. It's not chronological in order. It's just like set in there of its own. But with the thought in mind that this is the way this book was written, and that this book is a center part, we find that verse 11 becomes the highlight, the point of the whole story. The fact, what I've just quoted, that they overcame him by the blood of the Lamb because they were not afraid of death, and they gave a word of testimony. We can overcome the pressure of this world if we are like that. That was the point of the book of Revelation, to encourage believers to stand against persecution. When we look at Revelation as being main purpose of future prophecy, we get twisted up. There is future prophecy there. But I think the main intent of the writer was to bring encouragement to believers. And the center highlight of his writing was that they overcame him by the blood of the Lamb, by the word of their testimony, and they were not afraid to die. We also see in this story, true in this story and true throughout ages, that God joins his people in their suffering. They were thrown in the fiery furnace, but there were four in that fire. Isaiah 43. Verse 1 and 2. But now thus saith the Lord that created thee, O Jacob, and he that formed thee, O Israel, fear not, for I have redeemed thee, I have called thee by thy name, thou art mine. When thou passest through the waters, I will be with thee. And through the rivers, they shall not overflow thee. When thou walkest through the fire, thou shalt not be burned, neither shall the flame kindle upon thee. He says, I will be with thee. In John 14, Jesus spoke to his disciples. And this is what he says. I will pray the Father, and he shall give you another comforter, and he will abide with you forever. Even the Spirit of truth, whom the world cannot receive, because it seeth him not, neither knoweth him. But ye know him, for he dwelleth with you and shall be in you. I will not leave you comfortless. I will come to you. Hebrews 13. One more passage here I want to read. Hebrews 13, verse 5, the end of verse 5. I'm sorry, yeah, 13. Be content with such things as ye have, for he hath said, I will never leave thee nor forsake thee, so that we may boldly say, the Lord is my helper. I will not fear what man shall do unto me. One of those 300 martyrs who were burned at the stake in England, before he went to the stake, he was asked to indicate that if God was helping him bear it, to raise his hand. And as the fire licked around him and he began to die, he raised his hands. God gives grace to endure the persecution that has come and that will come. You say, well, I can never bear that. No, you can't bear it because you're not in it. God doesn't give grace ahead of time. In Hebrews, he says, let us come boldly to the throne of grace in time of need and ask, and he will give us grace in time of need. In time of need, we receive the grace to endure what God has given to us, what will happen to us. The result of all that is that God is glorified. You know, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were saved from the fire. It was top news of the day, I'm sure. They were promoted in the kingdom, which was kind of nice. But the bottom line was, verse 28, then Nebuchadnezzar spake and said, blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who hath sent his angel and delivered his servants that trusted him, and have changed the king's word and yielded their bodies, that they might not serve nor worship any god except their own God. Therefore I make a decree that every people, nation, and language which speak anything amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be cut in pieces in their houses. be made a dunghill, because there is no other God that can deliver after this sort. God received glory. And that's the ultimate end of everything in life, whether you're blessed or whether you suffer persecution. 1 Corinthians 6:20 says, you're bought with a price, therefore glorify God in your bodies. 1 Corinthians 10:31 says, whatever you do, whether you eat or drink, whatever you do, do all for the glory of God. And not only do we glorify God while we live, but John 21, verse 18 speaks about glorifying God in our death. Now, I don't understand this at all. I've pondered this often. I'll just read it so you can get the full import of that. Jesus is talking about Peter. And he says, verily, verily, I say unto thee, when thou, that's Peter, wast young, thou girdest thyself and walkest whither thou wouldest, but when thou shalt be old, thou shalt stretch forth thy hands, and another shall gird thee and carry thee whither thou wouldest not. This spake he, signifying by what death he should glorify God. So it's not only important how we live, it's important how we die. I guess I gather from that. I want to conclude with one more thought. Daniel 3 follows Daniel 1. Well, duh. But there's a point to be made here. In chapter 1, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego refused to eat the king's meat. Now, there is none of the laws, none of the Ten Commandments forbade eating the king's meat. But they refused. The punishment in that case was not nearly as great as the punishment in Daniel chapter 3. In Daniel chapter 3, there was an obvious commandment that would be disobeyed. But in Daniel chapter 1, it's not so. Ravi Zacharias, I guess, I'm not exactly sure, but he says and he ponders and he thinks that the issue in Daniel chapter 1 was perhaps not a decision of morality, but of discipline. To eat the king's meat was a soft choice, a luxurious choice. Standing without compromise is preceded by a life of discipline. A person who stands without compromise didn't suddenly arrive at that place. They had lived a life before that of discipline. And then when the crisis came, they stood. You do not prepare for a crisis in the midst of a crisis. You prepare ahead of time. You set your life in order. You take precautions and steps. And then when the crisis comes, you've already prepared. 2 Timothy chapter 2, Paul gives Timothy three pictures of discipline, disciplined people. He talks about a soldier. He talks about an athlete. And he talks about a farmer. And each one of these, he points out that these individuals have to endure or do something or experience some kind of discipline in their life in order to reap the reward. Now, suppose a soldier decides that instead of enduring boot camp and running 5 miles every day, that he's going to just quit partway around the course. And instead of checking his gun every time, he's only going to check it once a week. And instead of eating the food they give him, he sneaks candy bars and sweets on the side. What happens when the battle comes? He won't be able to endure, because he hadn't trained. Or what about the athlete? Suppose he decides he's not going to work as hard as he should, and he takes a few days off in his training, and he gains a few extra pounds, and he takes it easy as he runs around the track. When the race comes, he'll lose. Or think of the farmer. You know, it's too cold to plow. I'll wait till it's warmer. And it's too hot to bale hay today, and I'll wait till it's cooler. And that farmer will fail. He'll go bankrupt. Every week you face many choices. Food, clothes, entertainment, how you use your time. And many of them seem insignificant. What does this little choice mean in the whole of life? But every choice you make is either you either can choose an easier way or a harder way. And if you make a practice of choosing the easier way, it becomes a habit. Soft choices lead to more soft choices. But the end result is a lack and a loss of discipline and failure in the day of crisis. Each choice you make either strengthens or weakens your soul's ability to stand without compromise. The Bible talks about overcomers. We want to be overcomers. But overcomers are those who arrived at that point by living a life of discipline so that they can stand without compromise in the day of crisis. We're going to sing two verses of a hymn. If there's anyone here tonight who would like to give their life to Jesus Christ, I invite you to stand until you're recognized. There's always a price to pay, but the reward is far greater than the price you have to pay. Please consider carefully as we sing from what number?
296.
296 in the Brethren Hymnal.